Well, good morning, everyone. I'd like to welcome you to the 65th term of this court. The court's first term was held in October of 1951. The first case we have today is the United States versus Nieto. Are the parties ready? Okay. Appellate can proceed.
Chief Judge Erdman, members of the court, may it please the court. I'm Captain Josh Grubon, along with my co-counsel. We represent the appellant. The military judge erred by failing to suppress evidence derived from appellant's computer. There was no probable cause to search or seize Specialist Nieto's laptop. And turning first to the May 2013 seizure, the only nexus between Specialist Nieto's cell phone and his laptop computer was an overbroad and unreliable profile created by Special Agent Sanifer. Now, one of the supplemental sites that we sent, Your Honor, was Weber. And in Weber, the Ninth Circuit case, it talked about the particularity requirement that goes beyond just the scope and face of an affidavit. Particularity also is a necessary component of probable cause. And so what Special Agent Sanifer essentially did was try to create a human characteristic that he then applied to the facts of this case to create a nexus.
Well, there's two things here, isn't there? On the one hand, there's this business about, well, soldiers usually send this stuff home, blah, 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 which, number one, we're dealing with contraband, so that's highly unlikely.
Yes, sir.
And anyway, that's just kind of hanging out there. But there's the other part, which is this capacity business. Now, frankly, I wouldn't know from Adam what the capacity of either one of them is, but it is asserted that, you know, people generally move stuff from little bitty things to large things because of capacity. How do you address that?
So, yes, Your Honor, that's the other thing that's wrong with the profile is the reliability, and it seems like that it is unreliable based off of those factors. It's just, first of all, the idea that Special Agent Sanifer cited his experience in seeing soldiers transfer data, and again, it's, as you say.
Well, that's the first prong. But the second prong is a mechanical argument.
Yes, Your Honor. And so the problem is that's based on an outdated understanding of technology. As the Riley, as the Supreme Court started in Riley about data storage, telephones or cell phones in this day and age have the capacity to store hundreds of videos, up to thousands of photographs. And so the idea that Specialist Nieto necessarily needed to transfer the data from a smaller digital device to a larger device isn't shown on the facts.
Well, if I'd been the magistrate, I would have known from Adam whether, you know, it could. Number one, I wouldn't know how to transfer it. Number two, I wouldn't know this pod holds this much and this pod holds. So how much do you need? You don't need a huge amount for probable cause.
No, Your Honor, but it's...
And it seems to me that if the government's got anything, they've got to hang it on that. So how do you answer? You're basically saying it's based on an outmoded...
Well, I'm saying, Your Honor,
notion of technology, but of course, I don't know what kind of technology your client had. Maybe he had outmoded technology.
Well, so it's the burden on the government in that sense to explain to the magistrate the nature of the technology. They had the ability to determine the data storage of capabilities of the phone, and they didn't.
They had his phone.
So that it's that information wasn't presented to the magistrate. So the magistrate was presented this incomplete concepts and unreliable concepts, and basically every Fourth Amendment case, every probable cause case is contextual. And so the context of this particular case, there just wasn't that information, and that information needed to be presented to the magistrate, especially when technology is always changing and being updated.
Now, it's talking about the very nature of phones. In your view, to what extent should the military magistrate, military judge, this court, look at the issue of the frequency with which cell phones are lost, stolen, and replaced that might have served as a motivation to transfer it from the cell phone to the laptop?
Your Honor, that, again, there would need to be data some of that information within the affidavit or some of that information communicated to the magistrate. That was not.
Now, what about common sense understanding of how the world works in terms of, from your viewpoint, should that factor in here?
Obviously, there is always going to be a certain aspect of common sense in these determinations, but I think when we're talking about data and the frequency with something like that happens, common sense would fail us in that context. We would be unable to predict with any amount of reliability the extent to which stuff like that happens. And so, again, the information that was given, that was stated as the basis, the idea that soldiers just transfer this data because of storage capability, and there was no information on storage capability, just because soldiers like to share the deployment experiences, that's not applicable here because there's no indication, based on anyone's common sense, that soldiers like to share with family members their criminal experiences. And so
That's kind of a narrowly, I agree, what was stated in the affidavit and by the special agent. To what extent, in your view, should the military magistrate have been looking at reasonable inferences in regard to what individuals who have cell phones and videos, multiple videos in this instance, the reasonable inference that they would want to transfer it over to a laptop?
Your Honor, to answer that question, I'd say in two parts. I think it's difficult to come up with what reasonable inferences are that people do with any sort of reliability and any sort of predictability, because the idea that people lose phones, so then they would back it up, what is the data behind that? What is the percentage of people who do that? How common of a human characteristic trait is that? I think that's something that no one really can say with any certainty. And that also dovetails to the broadness and the overbroadness of this profile.
How did they know that he had a computer?
That, Your Honor, that is unclear from the record. As the agents testified during the Article 39A session, they just knew. They're not sure how they knew. And if you look at the actual face of the search authorization, or excuse me, the seizure authorization for May 2013, it doesn't even identify the make or model of the laptop computer. It just says laptop computer that is in his bunk. So from the investigation and from the testimony that's available, it's unclear how they even uncovered that he had a laptop computer. But back to the overbroadness. This court, we would argue that this court shouldn't adopt the concept of just because human beings might transfer data in this way, that's particular enough for the Fourth Amendment. We would say it would be unreasonable to say just because people store stuff in their houses, and it's common knowledge that people store stuff in their houses, that this is the type of evidence that someone would store in their house, and that creates a nexus to then search the house. So we believe for that reason, there's no probable cause for the May 2013 seizure. Now turning to the July 2013 search. The problems, again, the only nexus created between the cell phone and laptop here is a profile. This profile is a little bit more particularized. Essentially, Special Agent Dunn says a voyeur of sexual acts is known to collect and store data. Now, the problem.
Well, it had a big difference. He admitted it.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, he admitted that he had masturbated to
the phone.
To the phone.
Right.
Right. Right, Your Honor. There's still
nothing. That's a rather large difference.
Your Honor, well, we would argue and submit that admitting that he took sexual gratification from the images that he kept does not create a nexus to the laptop computer, though, just because as in JA-109, we've attached the interview with Specialist NATO, and in this interview, he denies that there's any connection to the laptop computer. He denies that there's any evidence on the laptop computer. He says he deleted the videos, and given the nature of smartphones, it's entirely possible that he viewed as indicated in his interview, that he viewed the images on his cell phone when taking sexual gratification from it. So, yes, there is that admission, but that still doesn't get you the laptop computer. And the problem with this profile of voyeurs of sexual acts is this is an unreliable profile on the face of the affidavit. There's no indication that this profile is accurate or accurately states reality. As this court decided in Hoffman.
Well, there's voyeurs of sexual acts. I mean, voyeurs of people going to the bathroom. But there wasn't any evidence that he was watching sexual acts, was there?
Correct, Your Honor. And that's the second problem with this profile, is it's not even clear that it's applicable to Specialist NATO. The discovery of sexual acts was uncovered after the laptop was analyzed, and it turned out there was evidence that sexual acts were on the video, but that was unknown at the time that the search and seizure was done. And so that's the second problem, is that it's not even applicable to Specialist Nieto. But as this court ruled in Hoffman, the self-avowed statements of a law enforcement officer when they're talking about the connection in Hoffman, it was the connection between child enticement and child pornography, and the affidavit said there's, in the agent's experience, 70-80% of the cases showed this connection, this nexus between people who entice children and then have child pornography on the computer, and this court decided that that's insufficient. The self-avowed statements of a law enforcement are not enough to create a nexus. And that's especially, in that case, it was even stronger than it was here, because in that case, the officer cited to, there was, I believe they had a degree in psychology, they talked about that in the affidavit, they also provided these statistics. In this case, there's none of that. There's just one statement creating the nexus. This statement is not explained or buttressed, and then it turns out that this statement doesn't even create the nexus. So for those reasons, Your Honor, there's no probable cause to search the computer based off of the July 2013.
Well, Hoffman turned on the fact that solicitation or attempted solicitation and possession of child pornography weren't inherently linked. Don't you have a closer nexus when you've got taken pictures, and then question is, are there pictures on the computer?
And, Your Honor, I disagree that there's a closer link simply because he used one medium capable of storing digital devices. Now, the government cited some cases that suggest that other courts believe that there's a link between voyeurs and maintaining child pornography.
Well, no, you've got a point as to the sexual voyeurism as opposed to the coprophiliac voyeurism.
Yes, sir.
But anyway, go ahead.
So, but we would say what distinguishes those cases from our case is that there's always an element of child pornography or child viewing children in that, which is separate than what Specialist Nieto did. In the cases that the government cited, I'm referring to, Your Honor, the supplemental citations. But Specialist Nieto's case was one which we're talking about adults, and he's taking images with his cell phone. So we would disagree with this simply because you use one device capable of storing digital data that opens up to searching all your devices.
Now, wait a minute. You lost me there.
Yes, Your Honor.
What is the presence of child pornography as opposed to what you might call coprophiliac pornography have to do with anything?
Well, Your Honor, I was answering a question you didn't ask, and so I apologize for that. I essentially was trying to address, I guess, issues with some of the government cases and in a way getting to a distinction of Clayton, and that wasn't the question you asked. But I would simply, to answer your question, Your Honor, if there is this connection, it would have to be based off of something a little bit more reliable than one sentence in our own intuition. The idea that voyeurs, because they use one digital device, that's possible, but I would say that doesn't rise to the level of a fair probability of what should be considered a reasonable application of probable cause, that you would reasonably find something.
What could the agent have said that would have created the necessary nexus?
That's a difficult question to answer, Your Honor, because I believe it simply must go beyond what the agent said. I could talk about factors that would have been a closer case, but I would argue that this court should adopt a rule similar to with Thien, the Washington Supreme Court case that we sent, that it should go beyond simply the self-avowed statements of law enforcement that create a nexus. There needs to still be a factual nexus of some sort. But what the agent could have said, Your Honor, that would have been made it a closer case, is they could have described any peer-reviewed studies, something that said, or a better and more complete survey of the cases that showed this connection, something that would create a reasonable inference that there is a connection between voyeurs and maintaining this digital data. What would have been helpful is during the interview of Specialist Nieto, had they asked more questions related to the transfer of data, more questions about his storage capabilities, and if he had ever backed up his phone, if they had done a test that tried to show some connection between his phone and his laptop, if there had ever been a syncing up in any way between.
We're talking about just the original seizure.
What's that, Your Honor?
The initial seizure, right? Because if the initial seizure was wrong.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right, then they can't cure it later.
Well, Your Honor, that is the position we took in the brief, but I agree that Hoffman's clear on that. If there's no probable cause in that first seizure, then that's the end of the story. But I just felt it necessary to discuss how there's no probable cause for either. But for the first one, what they could have done differently, considering they don't even know that he's using these for sexual gratification as incapacity, it's difficult to say. They could have probably made a fair inference that he was a voyeur at that point, considering the evidence of him putting his cell phone over the stalls and people seeing it. So in that sense, I think they could have created a better profile, a more particular profile in that first instance that would have been a voyeur's, but it's difficult to say how they could have created a nexus unless maybe they'd analyzed the phone on its own and were able to determine that there was some transferability of data that happened on the phone. It's hard to see what they could have done in that instance.
Counsel, I think all courts now need to be mindful of the dilution of Fourth Amendment principles in the digital age. Let me throw at you an analogy, and it's certainly not consistent with what happened in this case in all fours, but I'd just like to see how you would approach this. Let's say it's 50 years ago, units deployed in Vietnam, Polaroid camera, photos taken with the latrine, then the search request is for the soldier's footlocker. What would have been the result, in your view, for looking at a footlocker when there's a deployment overseas at that time and the special agent essentially says, this is where soldiers store things that they want to keep? And that's why I'm looking for authorization to search it.
That is an interesting question, Your Honor. I mean, I think this in part turns on the way the contraband is handled. I mean, if it's you're in that sense looking for the actual Polaroid photos, and I think you would be able to look for those Polaroid photos. And I guess the distinguishing with Nieto is. The difference is they could look for it on a cell phone. So they could look for a cell phone. They could have searched his room for a cell phone. They could have looked in a footlocker for his cell phone. And so that's how I'd answer that. There would be probable cause to look for the cell phone. And I see I'm out of time. If I just may finish.
You can finish the question. Then I have one more.
Yes, Your Honor. And so that's what distinguishes this case is they could have looked for the cell phone. They had a probable cause for the cell phone, just as the same as they could have for those particular Polaroid photos.
Why would they have probable cause if the cell phone was in his footlocker?
So if they have probable cause to see that he's using the cell phone, I guess in the particular circumstances they do, they see him walk back to his I'm assuming some facts in that hypothetical, Your Honor. They see him immediately walk back to his room, and after they've witnessed him using it illicitly, and then they, I think at that point, have probable cause to search his room. I think the cases are clear on that.
But wouldn't they have to establish that they saw him take the picture, he took the phone, he went back to his room, and now he doesn't have it on him?
Yes.
So therefore, they believe it's in his room.
Yes, Your Honor. They would in that scenario. And the reason I was making those assumptions in the hypothetical is I was imagining.
Well, answer Judge Olson's question. Like, what would they need? Would they just be able to rifle through his footlocker?
No, Your Honor. And the reason. They wouldn't, in that sense, without establishing those facts. And I was imagining the facts as we had in this case, where they sort of caught Specialist Nieto red-handed in a way. So I'm assuming it's a situation where they catch him red-handed, but the reason they're looking at his footlocker is because he's somehow gotten away with the contraband. So, no, Your Honor, that just because they see someone committing an offense outside your home, I think cases are pretty clear on that. You can't get to then search within somewhere where you have a reasonable expectation of privacy unless you create a factual nexus. So,
counsel?
Yes, Your Honor.
Assuming that the court agrees with you, you have asked us to set aside the findings in the sentence. But it seems to me that the content of the laptop only go to charge 3 and the additional charge. Where is your basis for us setting aside the remainder of the charges?
Yes, Your Honor. The basis was simply as part of the plea and the nature of the conditional guilty plea that it allowed him to withdraw his plea. And so we believe if this court suppresses the laptop for any reason, part of the contract that he engaged in with the convening authority allows him at that point to withdraw his plea. And so we'd ask for this court
to withdraw his plea to all offenses?
Yes, Your Honor. That was the terms of the OTP.
Okay. Thank you. You'll have time. Do you have time on rebuttal? Did you ask for that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. We'll now hear from the government.
Chief Judge Erdman, members of the court, may it please the court. My name is Captain Tara O'Brien Goebel, and together with Major Michael Cordy, I represent the United States. This court can affirm the findings and sentence in this case on two separate grounds. First, the military judge did not abuse his discretion in finding the magistrate's authorization was supported by probable cause. And second, even without addressing probable cause, this court should find that the good faith exception applied. In this case, the military judge did not abuse his discretion because his findings of fact were not clearly erroneous and he properly applied the law.
This Counsel, court should. In this case, the facts were essentially stipulated. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. There was a stipulation of fact in this case.
Okay, so we're not really arguing about the facts. And in our probable cause law, we've said that we'll give substantial deference to the determination of the magistrate in finding probable cause. But as you noted, this is an abuse of discretion standard for a ruling on a motion to suppress, a denial of a motion to suppress. So my question is, just how far does that substantial deference go? In this case, we're not really arguing about any facts at all. This is essentially a legal question. And when we look at legal questions, we look at whether or not the magistrate or the military judge in this case has misapprehended the law. So where does that substantial deference come in a case like this?
Yes, Your Honor. In determining, giving the magistrate substantial deference, this court should look to the totality of the circumstances in determining whether there was substantial evidence supporting the magistrate's decision that there was probable cause. So while reviewing the law, this court should certainly determine whether there was substantial evidence based on the totality of the circumstances, but not so much whether this court would find that there was probable cause, just that there was substantial evidence in support of the determination.
How did the government know that he had a computer? Like, where is that established?
Your Honor.
Because, I mean, it says, you know, that they get to search his bunk and area for the laptop computer, the cellular telephone syncs with to upload and download data, right? Where do they establish that such a computer exists? And how do they know that he uses a computer in that matter? Because I may be more savvy than Judge Stuckey, but I don't have my smartphone sync with my computer.
Your Honor,
where do they establish that connection?
Yes, Your Honor, during the motions hearing, the special agent testified that he believed that he was aware that the appellant had a computer in his bunk, and he stated that he wasn't exactly sure where he got that information, but that his agents had given him information that came from somebody, potentially his platoon sergeant or somebody in the command, who probably went in and saw the computer sitting on his bunk.
What about the uploading and downloading? The syncing part. I mean, did they have any evidence, did they present any evidence that he used his computer in that manner? Because, you would agree that if they had presented those facts, this would be a very different case.
Your Honor, while they have no evidence that appellant definitely did sync his phone to his computer, they had evidence that he had a phone and that he had a computer. And those facts were...
Seven or eight computers between my two homes, okay? And I'm here to tell you I don't sync my phone with them at all. So, I'm just saying.
Yes, Your Honor. Based on the evidence that was presented to the magistrate, the magistrate can make the inference that he did sync his phone to his computer.
Well, and it is important to note that... Well, if a magistrate can just make that inference, then why, whenever anyone uses their cell phone for various purposes, doesn't that give the government an opportunity to seize all electronic devices within a person's home?
Your Honor, it would depend on the facts and circumstances. I think it turns on probably ownership and opportunity. So here we had a situation where the appellant did have did have a computer that we knew that he owned. On top of that, we knew that he had the opportunity to access that computer based on the proximity between
the... So that's the only dividing wall? If someone owns a number of electronic devices, and if they've had some opportunity, which we know nowadays with syncing can be a flash, all there has to be is ownership and opportunity, and then the government can use its prying eyes to get into a citizen's every electronic device?
It would depend on the type of crime we are dealing with. So in this case, you're dealing with video recordings where appellant was seen video recording over the latrine stalls.
Let's just stop with that. So you're saying that if there is a video recording that is of a improper nature, let's stipulate that that's what we're talking about. So if a video is found on a cell phone, your argument is that if that individual owns a computer and has an opportunity to access that computer, that's enough to get a search warrant.
Depending on the circumstances that were presented to the magistrate, but where there's information presented to the magistrate that there is ownership, there's proximity, so there's opportunity for concealment, probably. In looking at the determinative factors, which are the type of crime, the natures of the item sought, and the extent of the suspect's opportunity for concealment, and then the normal inferences as to where a criminal would hide that sort of information.
But don't you think that Judge Olson's question raises the fact that that is a pretty broad grant of authority to the government?
Why couldn't they just search the entire house? Because, I mean, maybe he printed them off. Maybe he took digital copies. I mean, he could have.
Well, Your Honor, in this case, it was limited.
I understand. He was in Afghanistan. But, like, let's make it, you know, some other thing, you know, that they were doing this and then they went to their house. You know, and they have six computers, like I do, not because I love computers, but because my husband and I both have computers, and they're here, they're there, they're the other place. Why couldn't you just say, or that you could search all of them? You know, or that I might have, you know, that might have printed off the pictures or copied them to a videotape.
Your Honor, in the cases, one of the cases that the government supplementally cited. State v. Enyart, the court did actually find that there was a substantial basis and probable cause based on the appellant in that case video recording, while it was children, the same sort of situation in the bathroom having a video recorder. Based on that, the court did find that there was probable cause to search appellant's home for all digital media devices. But here, we had a warrant that was...
The government gets carte blanche. You have a video on one device. You can search everything. Everything that, you know, go in the basement, root around. There might be some old 8mm movies down there.
But how about it's a different sort of crime, right? Someone, you know, we know for a fact that the accused stole many things from a store, right? He could have taken them to his home. Right, or he could have taken them to his garage, or he could have taken them to his workplace. Why can't you get a search authorization for all three of those places with nothing more?
Your Honor, the
I mean, it's a real question.
Right.
Because, I mean, he could have taken them there, but doesn't the law require more?
The law requires that there's a fair probability that he took them.
But he had to put it someplace.
Or he deleted them, and they don't exist.
Certainly, Your Honor. However, in looking at whether or not, for instance, his home, many circuits have held, including the Ninth Circuit, in United States versus Lucardis, which was also supplementally cited. In that case, the court was dealing with the appellant who stole mail pouches. And the court addressed whether or not there was probable cause to search the appellant's residence. And the court looked to the fact that the mail pouches were the type of material that court would expect the appellant to have hidden at home based on both the value and the bulk. And they also talked about the ample opportunity that the appellant had to go home in order to hide those mail pouches. Now here, we have videos that the appellant was seen by numerous witnesses recording. The magistrate was able to infer that based on finding appellant recording those videos, that there was a fair probability that he transferred those videos onto his computer. The magistrate didn't need to find beyond a reasonable doubt that he had in fact synced those videos to his computer, just that there was a reasonable probability or fair probability that he could have. Where a computer is a reasonable place to find that videos would be hidden, the magistrate did have a substantial basis in probable cause.
And the reason for that apparently is the fact of the existence of the computer and the proximity of the computer. I mean, that's what I'm getting from the government's argument.
Your Honor, because the warrant was specifically limited to the one digital media device, in this case, we aren't even dealing with whether or not they had probable cause to search every digital media device. In this case, they didn't. They only had probable cause to search the computer.
But if he had seven, why wouldn't the same rationale apply, the government's rationale for the one apply to all of them?
If he had seven, the rationale would, if he had seven computers in the same location, which was in his bunk, where the probable cause existed, and there perhaps would be probable cause to search all seven of those. But that's based on, first, articulated the number of people who saw him recording the videos, the fact that you can reasonably infer that the computer does have a larger storage capacity for the videos.
Let me change the subject just for a second. We can come back to this. Do we know why they only obtained a warrant for the seizure and then sent the cell phone to be searched, and the individual who was doing that, the digital technician, said, I can't search it. You don't have a warrant for that. And then they went ahead and got the warrant for the search. Isn't that kind of a strange bifurcated process?
Certainly, Your Honor.
Do we know why that happened?
Your Honor, there's no information on the record why they did not do a search authorization at the same time they did a seizure authorization. However, from the course of the facts and the way things play out, it does not appear that they were freezing the scene for the subsequent search authorization. Instead, it appears that they did believe they had.
But in fact, didn't they freeze the scene? They had control of the laptop.
Certainly, they had control over the laptop while they waited for the subsequent.
And doesn't that freeze anything that's on the laptop?
Yes, Your Honor, it would freeze anything that's on the laptop, but during the course of that time, the laptop was waiting in the line to go through its digital forensic examination.
Well, but it's waiting in the line because he didn't have a warrant. He had no, you know, he had nothing that said, you, Mr. Technician, can search this computer. All it says is, it's seized.
It appears from the course of events and what happened, Your Honor, that he did believe that at that point in time he did. He sent it to be searched, and the digital forensic examiner did contact them in order to get the search authorization. However, the subsequent search authorization was based on very similar information that the original seizure authorization.
Right. Okay. Tell me why this is not Hoffman.
Your Honor, as it relates to the freezing of the scene or as it relates to...
Tell me why this case is not Hoffman as regards probable cause to search.
Your Honor, in Hoffman, the probable cause was based on the law enforcement officer's experience in relating one crime to another crime. So essentially, people who are child molester type of people are likely to have child pornography. This is a very different situation because here we have evidence of a crime and we're dealing with whether or not...
Well, there is evidence of a crime. Solicitation or attempted solicitation.
Yes, Your Honor. So we're dealing with, in this case, where the evidence of that specific crime would be found, whereas in Hoffman you're dealing with people who commit this crime probably also commit this crime. That's
well,
making them much more
the only, all you're doing is pushing it back a step instead of opining from his vast experience that people who stick their heads out of the windows of pickups and talk to kids, have child porn. You're opining that people who wave phones around in bathrooms have stuff on their computers.
Your Honor, I think the difference is that you're...
Somebody's opinion.
Yes,
Your
Honor.
The only factual thing in here other than, well, you know, troops tend to send stuff home is capacity, and, you know, and we're told that capacity doesn't make any difference. I don't know.
Well, Your Honor, as it relates to capacity, the magistrate could infer that the computer would have a larger capacity to hold videos than the phone.
Okay, it may have had a larger capacity. Is that enough?
Your Honor, it's everything taken together, and everything taken together in this case shows that there was a substantial basis in probable cause. However, even if this court finds that there wasn't a substantial basis in probable cause, this court can still and should still apply the good faith exception, as has been done in numerous previous cases by this court, including United States versus Carter.
Counsel, before we get there, I'm wrestling with the practical implications of the government's argument. Based on your argument, would the government be able to get into anything stored on the cloud by the appellant in this case or any accused in the future if they've used a cell phone?
Your Honor, if they've used a cell phone to commit a crime, and that's what the evidence is, that the evidence of the crime may be on the cell phone, then perhaps they would be able to get into the cloud to look for the evidence.
So doesn't that raise a specter of a slippery slope here about just how far the government can go when an individual commits an offense with one electronic device? Doesn't that open the door for everything?
Your Honor, it probably depends on the type of offense that you're talking about the appellant committing with one particular device. So you would have to look at the facts and circumstances surrounding that crime. But in this case, where we're dealing with videos that the appellant was found to have been recording on his cell phone, and you're dealing with the fact that the search warrant was so limited in this case, and perhaps that is big here because the CID agent testified that he did have a back and forth with the magistrate where the magistrate asked questions about transferring from the phone to the computer. So here you have information that based on that back and forth between the CID agent and the magistrate limited the search authorization only to the computer that syncs up to the phone. So it's much more limited than dealing with all electronic devices.
Answer this question, because I don't know the answer to it, but hopefully you will. Is it possible by searching the phone, would it have been possible to tell whether the phone had been used in the manner that you're describing, that the things had been, that it had synced with a computer and that images had been transferred?
Your Honor, there are different ways that transfers can happen. In this case, the appellant had a Samsung Galaxy, so there are many different ways you can sync that up. You could sync it up with something called Dropbox.
That's not my question. My question is, could you, by searching the phone, tell whether images or videos have been transferred from that phone to another device?
It would depend on how the syncing happened. So whether if it was plugged in, you probably would be able to tell the last time that it plugged in. If it was the cloud, you'd be able to tell the last time that the cloud had been updated. But if it was a Dropbox or something of that sort, maybe not.
Okay, but the way that it actually happened in this case. So I guess what my point is couldn't they have searched the phone, right, and then had probable cause to search the computer?
Probably, Your Honor. And based on that, the fact that they could have searched the phone and had probable cause to search the computer, I think that this court can still find that the military judge did not abuse it.
I understand. I was just trying to sort of flesh out a limit or a way that law enforcement can do its job without opening up a Pandora's box of if you have one electronic device that all electronic devices can be searched.
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, would your argument be different if the investigator had not offered his opinion on how soldiers use their phones and their computers?
The investigator's opinion in this situation was important because it was helpful in allowing the magistrate to make an informed decision and use any inferences and common sense on top of that opinion to determine whether there was probable cause. So yes, that his opinion and the fact that he did state that it had been formed not just through personal experience but other investigations was helpful in this situation.
Well, that's different than just the magistrate using his or her own inference or coming to his or her own inference without such an opinion from the investigator. Isn't it different than that?
Exactly, Your Honor. It is different. And while the magistrate is allowed to use her own common sense and ways of the world in making that determination, this fact was extremely helpful in her ability to do that, because the law enforcement officer would have more knowledge about the way things are regularly transferred.
And as I recall from the record, this investigator had a fair amount of experience, at least as indicated in the 39A session. Isn't that right?
He did. He had, Your Honor, permission to answer the question?
Please.
He had extensive experience. The investigator who requested the original seizure authorization was the supervising CID investigator. He had about 15 years of experience and had worked. He was also the digital forensic examination supervisor or coordinator at that point in time. So he did have a significant amount of experience.
Thank you.
Pending further questions, this court should affirm the findings and sentence in this case because there was a substantial basis and probable cause for the magistrate to issue the authorization, and even without deciding whether there was a substantial basis and probable cause, the evidence was properly admitted under the good faith exception.
Thank you. Rebuttal.
First, to address the questions about syncing up the laptop and the cell phone, we would argue that that is only relevant when talking about an absence of good faith on the part of the investigators. While that was in the face of the affidavit that the phone and computer synced up, there was no factual predicate. There's no factual predicate to discuss that they, in fact, had synced up. And so while in our brief we relied on Hoffman's application of the military good faith doctrine, if this court feels that the test under Leon applies, we feel that in the affidavit, the discussion of a synced up cell phone and laptop without any evidence would be a recklessly misleading statement. And we had also, coupled with the fact that the profile that Special Agent Dunn gave didn't apply to the facts of this case, we find that that is also recklessly misleading. And as well, we think that these are bare bones affidavits. Just by the length and the quantitative material in these affidavits, they don't even reach half a page. One's four paragraphs, one's six paragraphs. But they also don't include contradicting information, as this court discussed in Leedy in interpreting Carter. That's a factor of a bare bones affidavit. And in the
counsel, can I ask you a question before time runs out? The government has indicated that they can rely, or we should rely, on the good faith exception in this case. Now, MRE 311B has the requirements for such an exception. And I thought that under the rule that one of the exceptions or one of the requirements is that you have to have a substantial basis for reaching the probable cause determination to begin with, right? What do you have to say to that?
I agree with that interpretation, Your Honor, and that's what we said in our brief, and we agree with this court's interpretation of Hoffman to that point. I'm merely arguing in the alternative, even if that's not the rule, we think that good faith doctrine doesn't apply. And in part, it's based off of, in addition to the bare bones affidavit, just some
facts. Well, I'm focused on this part of the rule because if the reason for the invalidity of the search is that there was no substantial basis for the magistrate to rely on in reaching the probable cause determination, wouldn't that negate any analysis at all under the good faith exception under MRE 311?
Yes, Your Honor. And as we say in the brief, we completely agree, Your Honor. That would negate it, and that's the end of the discussion.
Please.
Judge Sparks asked the government counsel about reliance on the agent's experience in his testimony that people do X. What's your view of how you square that with our recent decisions about sort of like generalities in terms of, based on my experience, criminals often hide their contraband in their home?
Yes, Your Honor.
Would that be enough?
I think that's one way to do it, but I think there's several ways to address that as well. I think in this particular case, Special Agent Sandefur didn't cite his experience as a basis from which he made these conclusions, though, as the military judge's findings of fact indicate, and then as our reply brief, we cited the four citations to the JA when he kept referring it to in a way as his personal experience. And he was unable to, in the language he used, talked about what he'd seen as far as sharing deployment photos. And when specifically asked about cases that he had seen this before in his 30 years of experience, he couldn't name one.
But my other question is, if an agent testified to a magistrate that in his experience of 30 years, criminals usually hide their contraband in their home, would that be sufficient to support probable cause, even if it was like the FBI agent?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. And the reason, you can look to Hoffman and how Hoffman dealt with the affidavit of the agent citing to 70% of the cases that they dealt with having this inference, and this court analyzed the reasonableness of that inference and saying, there's no natural connection with that. And so I would say that this court has already dealt with that issue and said that it's insufficient, but that's also one of the supplemental sites and theme discusses is if this court were to allow a rule where a self-avowed statement to expertise form the basis of a nexus, then that would be an open invitation for law enforcement to state or create nexus, in essence, out of thin air and open everything up to searching. And then we'd have to worry about the slippery slope issues that this court was asking about.
Can a person store data in the cloud directly from their cell phone?
Your Honor, my understanding is yes. And that was another point we were hoping to make on rebuttal, is all these technological questions with Judge Stuckey and Judge Ryan being unclear on what the capabilities of phones are at this stage. The Fourth Amendment requires a contextual analysis. Each case is specific. Considering technology is always changing, and now the capabilities of the cloud are changing, this information needs to be in the affidavit. This information needs to be communicated to the magistrate to talk about what the technology is and as the technology exists at that time, and based off of a proper understanding of technology, one that can be tested and analyzed, then you can determine the reliability of that information.
Okay, I see your time has expired.
Thank you.
Okay. The court thanks the parties for their arguments. The court will be in recess until about 10:35.
All rise. Court stands in recess until 10:35.